Backchat.
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 Your alternative to talkback.
Backchat.
On FBI Radio.
We'll be joined by the Coalition of Aboriginal Peak Organisations to hear about their new partnership agreement with the state government, focused on closing the gap in Indigenous disadvantage.
But right now, we're chatting all things country music. Have you suddenly got friends who are sending you country songs? Seeing it around social media? We dive into why country music is having its moment right now.
My partner has loved country music forever, and he is kind of annoyed that it's suddenly trendy. So we're going to have words.
I mean, I hate country music because it used to play it like every 21st that I would go to when I was a teen in the country. Mm. We'd all get absolutely wasted to the worst misogynistic country music song you've ever heard in your life. But I'm glad it's changing.
And of course, if any of that pricked your ears, then get in touch. Are you a concrete cowboy, a country and inner western fan? We want to know. Text us 0409 945 945 or DM us on Instagram at BackchatFBI.
Gentlemen, this is Democracy Manifest.
Backchat on FBI 94.5.
Beck, you probably saw this week that Beyoncé released two new country singles and has announced an upcoming country album. It's definitely made waves across the news as something unexpected.
I did see that. I'm incredibly excited. Unfortunately, I love it. It's definitely not something I would have picked for 2024, though. To dive into what may be behind all this, we're joined by Backchat producer Danny Zhang.
Hello. Good morning. Good
morning. So, Danny, maybe let's start from the beginning. So, what is country music?
Well, I mean, I think you're always going to run into trouble trying to define any genre of music, and there's never one set definition, and it's always changing. But I think what stands out across all country music is the storytelling. Barry, who I interviewed for this story, mentioned that it specifically might be stories about people or places, and common instruments you might hear are things like guitars and other string instruments like fiddles, banjos, and my personal favourite, the pedal steel.
And, you know, tell us why you think this rising popularity is interesting.
Well, Holly, when it comes to mainstream chart-topping music, I think it's safe to say country music has historically taken a bit of a backseat. And as a bit of a country music outsider, if you have a look at the country charts, you'd only really recognise a very small handful of artists that have quote-unquote broken out into the mainstream consciousness. And there are actually a lot of pop artists today who had their start in country music. Taylor Swift is a very obvious example, and Olivia Newton-John as well, if you're a fan of hers. But I think the transition the other way is a lot less common, which makes Beyoncé's announcement so much more interesting. To find out more, I spoke to Barry Harley. Barry is the country music manager for Tamworth Regional Council. Barry's been involved in the Tamworth Country Music Festival since the mid-70s, so he definitely knows his stuff and has seen a lot. I asked Barry what it is about country music that he thinks is connecting with young people.
Look, I think it's fair to say that country music has always been in the background of music, because popular music has generally been the rock, or at least the country rock at best. But what's happened is that I think there's an earthiness associated with country music, and which is being discovered by the younger people that are finding that it's more grassrootsy, it's fun, it's energetic. And often it's a story about people or about places, but it's easy to identify with. And I think there's a good time vibe associated with country music now than what potentially was, what traditionally has been associated with country music is the more pluck and strum bush ballad type thing, whereas the subgenres in country music now are so varied and many that it would be difficult not to find a piece of music that you liked.
Holly already mentioned Beyoncé's new country album, and just last year, Luke Combs sold out almost the entire Australian leg of his world tour after already making a huge wave in the States. I asked Barry if he thought it's the growth in America that has anything to do with Aussies loving it too.
Absolutely. I think, you know, cliche, a rising tide lifts all boats, and I think that's what's happened. As the consumption of music has become easier, obviously international is purely by population. Luke Combs appeals to 5% of the US audience is a multimillionaire. If he appealed to 5% of the Australian audience, he'd have a second job at IGA. And so to answer your question, yes, there is a heavy identity of international music that we're seeing being delivered by the Australian artists as well.
And if this story has piqued your interest, I asked Barry who we should check out and keep an eye on.
The current Female of the Year Golden Guitar winner is a Kiwi, Kaylee Bell. Now, Kaylee is a perfect example of that going through from the emerging artist, you know, in New Zealand, playing the Talent Quest and things like that, coming to Australia, busking, playing the Talent Quest. She won Toyota Star Maker. That sort of gave her a real lift. The male artist of the year, Brad Cox, is sort of, you couldn't get more authentic. He's as blokey as you can get, but he's also very Luke Combs in his appeal. He's you know, he's got the big beard and he sort of, you know, drinks on stage and what have you. And so he has an appeal to a particular group of people for a different reason, but he's inviting them in to be part of his culture.
And that story was produced by Danny Zhang. Next up, we'll be talking with the Coalition of Aboriginal Peak Organisations about the new partnership agreement aimed at closing the gap in Indigenous disadvantage. But for that, Beck, do you have any favourite country songs?
The only one I can think of that absolutely do not hate is the new Beyonce one, so.
How about you, Danny?
Oh, man. I actually have become a new fan of Zach Bryan, which is part of that whole social media. Sorry. Ooh. I like it.
Across social media, fitness and health influencing has become a mainstay with an overwhelming array of information on how to keep ourselves healthy. However, as of any topic on social media, disinformation is practically everywhere and can be difficult for the average internet user to decipher. Fitness and the social media influencing associated with it is no exception to this rule, with social media only ever expanding into how much it impacts our lives. Therefore, these trends and new guides are having an effect on how we view fitness. Recent resurgence of popularity for exercise such as Pilates and bar classes has been touted by some as a societal reflection of fitness trends nearly identical to that of the early 2000s. So how did we potentially regress to this point? Well, some see it as a post-COVID symptom of wanting to bring more comfortability into our routines that low-impact workouts can provide, others view that there may be larger cogs at play. To dissect this, I sat down with highly accredited sports scientist Philippe Jacquard from the University of Sydney to discuss what other current societal trends are affecting the way that we exercise. Do you believe that the resurgence of low-impact workouts is purely a trend or will persist?
So what's happening is people are thinking that the Pilates is actually an indication of what we call fitness. Fitness can be defined in many different domains. We've got strength and power and what we call aerobic capacity, you know, the heart and the lungs to deliver the fuel, the oxygen to burn the fuel at the muscle cell level. Fitness can be defined in all these other time and modality domains. And so what we know about Pilates is it's good for lower back pain. And if you're at a really, really low baseline of fitness, in inverted commas, because it's a generic term, it can help with trunk stabilization, the core in inverted commas as well. The back pain is related to an unstable core. The spine is just an attachment point for muscles and the ligaments and the tendons and stuff attached to the spine. It's not actually meant to take much force. So what the evidence is telling us, that can reduce back pain, but a whole heap of other stuff can do that as well. It will be around for a little while. It's more of a lifestyle. Pilates and yoga is more of a lifestyle as opposed just to the intervention itself. You know, people call it, especially with yoga, people call it spiritual and, you know, mentally stable. And the body is generally, as a cross-section of the body, when you look at someone's body type, it's an indication of how well they're looking after themselves, you know, as an average. There's variation, genetic and variations. And so I think it's going to be around for a little while, but as an intervention to translate what we call disseminate or how that type of intervention will affect the global system, which we would define as functional capacity, you know, activities of daily living. And, you know, if you're an older adult, picking up the grandkids and going to the park or pushing the mower or risk of disease, it does not reduce risk of disease at all. It reduces back pain. I think it's going to be around for a little while.
Do you believe fitness influencing as an industry has exacerbated the room for toxicity within fitness spaces?
The influencers, like social media is really, it's a evil entity. You know, especially with younger humans, and they're, you know, the mind is still being shaped, you know, like plasticine and what I believe fitness is someone who's really jacked, or, you know, like that's what we would define at the university higher level education would define it as. That's pure aesthetic. We call that extrinsic motivation. I'm getting a reward from an external validation of how, what you think about me. My likes is extrinsic motivation. How many followers I have is extrinsic. So when we talk about a longitudinal adherence to an exercise intervention, right? That's what we call changing the body, changing the mind, changing the physiology, the genetics. It has to be a dose that's implemented over time. And that affects the system globally. We talk that when I start getting into the fact that I'm feeling good, I'm getting stronger, I'm getting better on the roll, the bike, or I can run further, my sense of effort comes down, and I just feel good. I'm sleeping better, I'm eating better, and I look at myself in the mirror and I feel better, my genes are feeling better. We call that extrinsic motivation. We're now getting validation from the intervention that's accumulating over time, it's starting to affect my psychology. You know, you can apply that to smoking. Any lifestyle change is driven by the psychological rewards that we get over time, and over time it becomes natural. We adopt this new lifestyle and it just becomes something that we do, and that we call that intrinsic motivation. So the influencers, I think they're really quite evil. It's all about, it's a version of capitalism, and they're trying to sell a product, they're trying to get you.
So what can we do as consumers in the fitness community? Well, that is completely up to us. The actual problem that must be tackled is how we consume fitness information, especially from social media. So while we can still feel safe in relying on fitness influencers to show us fun workouts and enjoy a Pilates class with friends, it must be acknowledged how the buzzwords and trending fitness narratives can do serious harm.
That was producer Ewan Kiley with Philip Chicot from University of Sydney on the health and wellness buzzwords that we are subjected to on socials. And coming up now, we have a track from Mikaisha.
Not a drop in the ocean. I'm the river that flows like a great stampede. I'm history unfolding. I'm a moment in time that will not repeat. Can't you hear it? My soul inside the sound, I'm taking higher ground. I sing for better days, I sing for my people, and my people breathe through me. I sing to make a way, I sing for my freedom, and freedom is all I need. Remember my name, always. I'm the daughter of the way. I'm brave, I'm not afraid, I'm here for a reason. Eternity points to me.
7 days of creation. But 10,000 years just to get to me. I am the foundation of all that has been and all that will be.
I'm the daughter of the way.
Backchat, your alternative to talkback on FBI 94.5.
For as long as we can remember, closing the gap reports from the federal government have been pretty bleak when it comes to reducing Indigenous disadvantage.
Last week, the Productivity Commission released a scathing report demonstrating fundamental change across the entire system was needed to stop the doomed plan from failing across the board.
While the federal government are facing claims of failing to fully grasp the challenges, South Australia's state government are attempting to change this with a locally focused approach, putting in place a partnership agreement between local state government and Aboriginal community organisations back in 2021.
Now, the New South Wales government has become the second state to put in place a similar agreement. We're joined by one of the chairs of the Coalition of Aboriginal Peak Organisations, John Lihar, to unpack what this agreement means. Hello, John.
Good morning.
Now, John, how's the agreement going to operate?
The New South Wales Partnership Agreement represents a renewed commitment from the MIMS government to closing the gap. And it really is built off and drawn from the national agreement that was signed by the Coalition of Aboriginal Peaks back in 2020. Since then, the New South Wales Coalition of Aboriginal Peaks organisations here in New South Wales have been working tirelessly in collaboration with the New South Wales government to improve the lives of Aboriginal people across the state of New South Wales. The partnership builds on progress that we've made since 2020 while supporting the space to strengthen this in collaboration with the MIMS government. So it really is just incorporating all tiers of government, including local governments, which you would have seen in the signing of that agreement on Monday earlier this week.
And what's the timeline for what's expected to be achieved?
Well, it supports the national agreement, so it is that's in place already, and the life of that is on the national agreement, which is up until 2031. We hope to see the targets being met between now and then. In saying that, though, one of the strengths of the partnership agreement is that it is intended to be updated as needed and to make sure that it reflects the shared priorities, progress and feedback from Aboriginal communities across its lifetime.
And South Australia already have a similar agreement. How is this one going to build or learn from the South Australian agreement and, I guess, the national agreement as well?
Well, what the Aboriginal organisations, communities and governments feel the need in place to implement Closing the Gap in South Australia and in New South Wales is different because each of us are different, and that it contextualises the way in which we go about making that change. The New South Wales agreement is more detailed than the South Australian agreement, providing more of the how in the agreement will be implemented and each of the priorities and each of the parties' roles within it. In particular, it highlights the need for priority reforms to be at the centre of closing the gap and calls out the onus of government to change the way that they do things. It's really important that we have strong commitment from the government to examine the way that we work with communities and challenge the structures and the power dynamics at play when it comes to decision making.
You're listening to Backchat on FBI Radio, and we're talking to John Lihar, co-chair of the Coalition of Aboriginal Peak Organisations, about the new partnership agreement on closing the gap with the state government.
How is this agreement going to buck the reports of fundamental change needed to prevent the national Closing the Gap strategy from failing?
Well, it focuses on putting the onus on governments to change how they do things and really making sure that the priority reforms are at the centre of everything that we do. That is what we believe will make the difference. The priority reforms are at the heart of how we will make the fundamental change needed. They show the government the path for making ambitious and transformative shifts and are necessary. And they put the perspectives and priorities of Aboriginal communities at the centre of closing the gap, because when Aboriginal people have a genuine say in decisions, better outcomes are achieved.
And what are the levels of support expected from the agreement? So how is this going to impact different communities and organisations individually?
Yeah, well, Closing the Gap calls on the government to make ambitious and truly transformational change to the work, to the way that they do the work that they do, in particular with our people. The great achievements have been made and we celebrate them, but we must acknowledge that we still have a long road ahead with plenty of hard work that still needs to be done to reach the targets by 2031. Sustained commitments to completing and implementing Closing the Gap and developing or delivering the solutions with the Coalition of Peak or Aboriginal organisations have put forward representatives of our communities and is vital to ensuring that the position and is positive positions the positive outcomes continue to deliver for our communities. And sustained commitment is the only way that we can implement real meaningful positive change for the future.
These reforms for government involvement and the pathways towards closing the gap accordingly, what are these reforms, how are they going to change the results we are seeing?
Sorry, could you say this includes, could you repeat that one?
Yeah, so these reforms for government involvement and the pathways mm-hmm. towards closing the gap accordingly, you know, like how are they going to change the results that we're seeing?
Yeah, it's because we're shifting the way that governments do business. So we're really asking them to go into engage in a dialogue of shared decision making that enables us to make informed decisions and informed discussions. But it's about seeing the Coalition of Aboriginal Peaks and Aboriginal people fundamentally as equal parts of that decision making process. But it also acknowledges that the systems in which underpin the bureaucracy are fundamentally needed to be revised and reviewed to think about how can we do business differently. An example of that would be Aboriginal-led commissioning, enabling Aboriginal people to be at the forefront of designing procurement processes, enabling Aboriginal people to be a part of legislative reform. So these are ways of doing that have already seen significant achievement and progress towards closing the gap. It's not merely about the target, but to fundamentally shift the way that governments are doing business in and of itself is a critical achievement when it comes to the self-determination of Aboriginal people across the state of New South Wales.
And finally, what is next? So do you think that we need this across other states to help shift the national agreement? Is this partnership going to be enough?
Absolutely. Leadership across this country at a Commonwealth level, state level, even at local levels, require us to do better. It requires strong leadership to ensure that the commitment to the targets and the partnership is fundamental. If we are going to see Aboriginal people be self-determining in resolving the challenges that are impacting us, it does mean that governments at all levels need to be able to enable that and enter into a partnership for that to happen. For the progress of this Closing the Gap agreement, it is critical that we are done with this work is done in partnership with all tiers of government and Aboriginal communities across the country.
Thank you so much, John. That was John Lehar, co-chair of the Coalition of Aboriginal Peak Organisations.
Let us know what you think. What would you like to see in this partnership agreement? Text in 0409 945 945 or DM us at BackchatFBI.
Backchat is produced by FBI Radio in Sydney. Tune in live every Saturday at 9:30 a.m. Find more at fbiradio.com/backchat.